Good evening and welcome to this extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for June 26th, 2026. I'm Lee Robartis. In the news tonight on today's show, we'll have an interview with Friends of the Clearwater Forest Policy Director Jeff Jewell about recent actions by the Forest Service to mostly eliminate the public from its decision-making processes, including by only giving a few days for public input on a proposed giant salvage timber sale across millions of acres in six national forests in Idaho and Montana. Some of that logging may have already begun. But first, world headlines from FSN and the Public News Service, followed by a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in London, I'm Stuart Smith. Almost 600 people have been killed, more than 1,500 injured, and around 50,000 people are missing after twin earthquakes struck Venezuela on Wednesday evening, the most powerful to hit the country in more than a century. More than 200 people are still believed to be trapped under the rubble of some 250 collapsed or damaged buildings. Schools across the affected areas have been closed and turned into emergency shelters, while hospitals are overwhelmed with the injured. Freelance reporter Catherine Ellis has been talking to people in Caracas from the Colombian border with Venezuela.
People are just in complete shock, just complete shock, and they don't know what's going to come next. Like, you know, this is a country that was starting to have a little bit of hope. They thought the economy is going to improve, things are going to get better, there was going to be elections. They really held that hope, and now it's kind of just this big dark black cloud. Schools are closed. These are like humanitarian rescue centers where people are sleeping, where they're eating, because they can't go back to their homes because it's too dangerous. There's been a lot of aftershocks as well.
Germany, Czechia and Austria will bear the brunt of the relentless European heatwave this weekend, with temperatures in Central and Eastern Europe in excess of 40 degrees Celsius. In France, the total number of drownings has now reached 55 since the 18th of June, as people continue to enter unsupervised rivers and lakes to try to cool off. Paris hospitals are saturated with people collapsing in the heat, and a temporary ban on buying takeaway alcohol has been introduced. Ross Cullen reports.
The situation is slightly better. We are now below 40 degrees. Today here in Paris it is 36, so that is better to be a few degrees cooler. It is still very hot in a city with no air conditioning. It's going to be 41 degrees this afternoon in the far east of France, and then that is going to move into Germany, the Czech Republic and Austria over the weekend, where they're expecting 41 to 42 degrees there on Sunday.
The United Nations Maritime Agency's evacuation of 11,000 stranded sailors from the Strait of Hormuz remains on hold after Iran's Revolutionary Guard struck a Singapore-flagged cargo ship near the Omani coast. The attack has raised questions about how the White House will respond, with US crude for August delivery dropping more than 1% on Thursday and Brent crude falling below $72 a barrel. Iran had warned it would deal with any vessel using a new route through the strait that Tehran called unacceptable. Mitch McCann has the story from New York.
Another consideration here is regarding how the US may respond, given that oil prices have plummeted, meaning that gas prices here and air fares are likely to come down in the coming weeks. The president will be cautious of the political implications if this war flares up again. So on one hand, he may be infuriated by these reported strikes in the Strait of Hormuz, but on the other, he may be cautious of the implications politically if he strikes back.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Civil rights leaders are condemning a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that clears the way for the Trump administration to end temporary protected status for people from Haiti and Syria who feel it's unsafe to return to their home countries. Legal experts say Thursday's outcome essentially means the courts can't get involved when the federal government ends a specific TPS designation in a way that draws scrutiny. Edward Ahmed Mitchell with the Council on American-Islamic Relations says they're deeply disappointed by the outcome carried by the court's conservative majority.
Ending these protections for hundreds of thousands of Syrians and Haitians will tear families apart, it'll disrupt workplaces, and it places vulnerable people at risk of harm.
Across different administrations, these TPS designations had been extended multiple times. They stemmed from catastrophic damages from a natural disaster in Haiti, as well as what was described as a brutal crackdown by Syrian dictator Bashar al-Assad. Last year, former Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem stated there were enough improvements for these individuals to return home. But groups like CARE say there's still too much conflict in Syria and that Haiti remains in disarray. Mitchell worries about the ripple effect in the immediate future.
The Supreme Court has essentially given a message to the president that it's open season on TPS holders. The logic of their decision would allow the president to cancel TPS for anyone he wants and avoid judicial review at the same time.
CARE also criticizes the court's conservative justices for not feeling that these TPS terminations were motivated by race. However, Mitchell was encouraged that Thursday's ruling still left some room to revive that argument. Justice Sam Alito acknowledged heated language by President Donald Trump and other members of his administration, but said there was nothing overtly racial. This is Mike Moen for Public News Service.
Ahead of America's 250th anniversary, advocates pushing for equality are organizing a nationwide day of action. Hundreds of cities and towns across the country, including some in Illinois, will host gatherings tomorrow. The movement is designed to counter what advocates describe as efforts to erase the contributions and experiences of Black and Brown communities to American history. Nicole Carty is with Get Free, a youth-led movement focused on advancing democracy and equality. She stresses this 4th of July should ignite acknowledge the full spectrum of American history, which includes reckoning with harms the country continues to inflict.
We're in a giant rollback of civil rights. We're seeing a militarized effort to remove Black and Brown immigrants from the country. We can't tell a whitewashed version of our story that is erasing this violence that's going on right now.
Carty says tomorrow's gatherings will also focus on how ignoring difficult aspects of the country's history perpetuates inequality and violence, and how important repair is to achieving a free America for all. Local events are planned for Chicago and Evergreen Park. People can learn more at allofus250.org. Carty stresses addressing historical harms has benefited all Americans. She notes the 14th Amendment, which was created to address post-slavery inequality, paved the way for LGBTQ and women's rights.
When Black people get free, when Native people get free, we all get free. And so we have a collective interest in continuing to address these harms to unleash a fair and just society for everyone who is here.
The Trump administration called for unity at a rally this week to kick off Independence Day celebrations, but its Freedom 250 initiative to celebrate the nation's 250th anniversary has sparked backlash over claims that it fosters division instead of solidarity. Carty stresses this occasion should be joyous and forecast a future America that's inclusive to all.
The only future that whitewashing our history gets us to is one where we are still unequal and only some wealthy white men have all of the rights. That's very much what we're seeing being constructed by the federal government.
Last week, a federal judge ruled the Trump administration must restore materials referencing slavery, indigenous people, and the climate crisis that he ordered removed from national parks across the country. The administration has until Independence Day to comply. For Illinois News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch.
New research shows conscientious objection laws targeting sexual minorities in states like Ohio are leading to lower HIV testing rates. At least 11 states now allow medical providers, including doctors and pharmacists, to deny care to patients based on their religious beliefs. Nathaniel Tran is an assistant professor at the University of Illinois Chicago's School of Public Health. He says young adults can't access the highly effective HIV prevention medication known as PrEP without that first test.
Folks are maybe sharing with the provider, hey, I'd like to get on this medication. And the provider might say, I don't really feel comfortable with that. I don't know about that. Or I think you should go somewhere else for that. That's not really my specialty.
Currently, one in five LGBTQ plus Americans live in a state where a provider can refuse them care. Tran says queer adults living in those areas are 28% less likely to report receiving a first-time HIV test compared to their peers living in non-restrictive states. Lawsuits challenging conscientious objection laws are currently underway. Meanwhile, Tran says a coordinated defunding of HIV prevention and treatment programs on both a state and federal level is adding to wide health disparities among sexual minorities. He notes peer countries like Australia are well ahead of the U.S. in working to end the HIV epidemic by ensuring access to not only testing, but nutrition and stable housing.
Those wraparound services both for prevention and for treatment, could get us to no new HIV infections in the United States. But I think that these funding cuts, both at the state and federal level, are pulling us back from that goal.
Tomorrow marks National HIV Testing Day. Public health departments and various community organizations nationwide are offering free confidential testing and free at-home testing kits. TRAN encourages LGBTQ plus people to check their status and find affirming healthcare providers to reduce medical harm. I'm Catherine Carley for Ohio News Connection. This story was produced in association with media in the public interest and funded in part by the George Gund Foundation.
128 members of the U.S. House of Representatives, including more than a dozen female lawmakers from California, are asking House Speaker Mike Johnson to pull an amendment they say hurts sexual assault victims. The amendment to the Build America 250 Act, the federal mega bill on transportation, would limit the liability of rideshare and delivery companies for harm on their platforms, including sexual assault. Representative Zoe Lofgren from San Jose says victims deserve legal recourse.
There's more than 3,000 sexual assault claims in federal court right now for Uber failing to implement adequate safety protections, and Uber's facing roughly 550 cases for allegedly failing to protect female drivers.
Republican California Congressman Vince Fong said he introduced the amendments to reduce transportation costs by limiting frivolous lawsuits. 285 female state legislators from across the nation also wrote to Johnson to express their outrage. Lofgren calls the amendment a poison pill.
They've had drivers with a history of sexual assault on the road, so we think it's an important measure, and we're not about to vote for this bill if this provision isn't taken out.
The issue has stirred controversy at the state level as well. Both Uber and Consumer Attorneys of America recently pulled competing ballot measures and agreed to support Senate Bill 623, which would allow women to request female passengers or drivers. It also requires rideshare companies to do annual driver background checks and reject drivers convicted of DUI or certain violent offenses. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Education unions in Connecticut and nationwide want Democratic governors to reject the federal voucher program implemented last year. It provides people a dollar-for-dollar tax credit of up to $1,700 for donations made to scholarship-granting organizations. But education leaders have signed a letter urging Democratic governors not to join the program, saying it drains money from public schools to further endow private education. Kate Diaz with the Connecticut Education Association says the program has too many unknowns.
We're just talking about taking money, diverting it from the federal budget and then letting it go into the ether of education with no oversight. And I think we've always stayed in the landscape of public money should have public oversight. And we're really talking about taking public money out of the public domain.
Estimates suggest the program would use $50 billion from the federal education budget, but data from pro-school choice advocacy group EdChoice finds 1.5 million students use private school choice programs in the 30 states that have them, an increase from previous years. So far, the only Democratic state to sign on to the federal program is Colorado, and the other 23 states signed on are all led by Republicans. The pitfalls of the voucher program have a strong impact on rural students. Data show voucher spending made up more than a quarter of K-12 funding for some states in 2025. The Economic Policy Institute notes that in rural areas with no private schools, the voucher program pulls funds from public schools. Diaz says the federal government should be concerned about providing equitable education access.
It's why the idea that they do civil rights complaints, the idea that where are the access points being restricted? And to see some of those things push away from the Department of Education at the federal level is really distressing.
Beyond the voucher program, the administration is taking steps to cut back access for special education. The Federal Office of Legal Counsel ruled on Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act and the Americans with Disabilities Act, saying neither federal law nor Supreme Court precedents enshrine the right of people with disabilities to live in communities. This means reducing safeguards and services for students with disabilities and limiting access to education opportunities. This is Edwin J. Vieira for Connecticut News Service.
Pennsylvania lawmakers are facing a budget deadline on Tuesday, and housing advocates plan to rally in Harrisburg on Monday to push a slate of bills aimed at making housing safer and more affordable. The group says the legislation would expand access to housing, prevent displacement, and protect residents across the Commonwealth. Pennsylvania has just 39 affordable and available rental units for every every 100 extremely low-income households. Eden Tinkleman with Pennsylvania Stands Up says constituents plan to gather outside the Senate chamber to make sure their concerns are heard. She says one key priority is Senate Bill 643, which would limit how criminal history is used in housing decisions.
If you have minor crimes, like minor drug crimes or just non-violent things, you shouldn't be discriminated against to get a house, particularly like in the rental setting.
Tinkleman notes the group is also hoping to meet with Senator Marty Flynn of Lackawanna County after a previously scheduled meeting was canceled. Governor Josh Shapiro's proposed 2026 to 2027 budget allocates $1 million to support stable housing. The investment builds on strategies in the Commonwealth's First Housing Action Plan, which focuses on promoting housing stability and long-term sustainability to benefit individuals and communities. Tinkleman says her group is also backing bills that focus on protecting residents of manufactured home communities. She says Senate Bill 745 and 746, along with House Bill 1250, would help stabilize costs and give residents a chance to buy the land their home is situated on before outside investors.
SB 745 prevents crazy rent hikes and fees. A lot of our senators we've heard don't like because something about like the fair market, it doesn't play into that well for like landlords. They feel it would be unfair.
Tinkleman notes the group is also backing House Bill 2028, the ending the criminalization of homelessness legislation. She emphasizes that unhoused people should not be penalized for being unhoused. For Keystone State News Connection, I'm Danielle Smith.
The public has just a few days left to comment on a proposed wastewater permit for Enbridge's Line 5 tunnel beneath the Straits of Mackinac. The permit is the latest step in a years-long debate over the aging pipeline and the risk of an oil spill. Environmental groups are urging regulators to closely examine the amount of treated wastewater that could be discharged, what it could contain, and Enbridge's proposal to use artificial intelligence to monitor the tunnel. Enbridge says the project would add new layers of environmental protection and wastewater would be treated to meet state requirements. But Ashley Rosinski with the Groundwork Center for Resilient Community says she's concerned Enbridge would be allowed to discharge about 7 million gallons of treated industrial wastewater into the Great Lakes every day.
There would be 5 million from the south outfall, 1 million from the north, and nearly another million in hydrostatic test water. There's also unquantified stormwater on top of that.
The wastewater permit is one of several state and federal approvals Enbridge still needs before construction can move forward. The public has until June 30th to submit comments before the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. Enbridge says it remains committed to responsible development and environmental stewardship. However, Rosinski is not convinced.
We know that monitoring isn't perfect, and it's always subject to human error. In this case, the Great Lakes are just far too precious to assume that any currently evolving AI technology is going to be enough to protect them.
Enbridge says the tunnel is designed to safely house the existing pipeline and that the company works closely with regulators and follows rigorous environmental review throughout the permitting process. State regulators are expected to make a decision sometime this summer. For Michigan News Connection, I'm Crystal Blair.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The lawsuit that Washington Attorney General Nick Brown led against the Trump administration over mail-in voting resulted in a ruling yesterday by U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani that Trump does not have the constitutional authority to regulate state elections. Starting in 2020, Trump has targeted mail-in voting with lies and misinformation. Since regaining the presidency, Trump has targeted mail-in voting with unilateral executive action. On March 31st, 2026, President Trump issued an executive order called Ensuring Citizenship Verification and Integrity in Federal Elections. The executive order was to create shadow voter eligibility lists within the federal government and use threats of investigation and prosecution to coerce states to disenfranchise voters missing from those lists. It also directly interferes with mail-in voting by mandating the United States Postal Service refuse to deliver voter ballots unless the voters are on the United States Postal Service pre-authorized list. Judge Tawani blocked key pillars of Trump's executive order that tried to interfere with states' constitutional authority to administer elections. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani concluded President Trump did not have the constitutional authority to regulate state elections. 23 attorneys general and one governor filed the lawsuit, with Washington Attorney General Nick Brown co-leading the challenge. The lawsuit challenged the Trump administration's attempt to restrict voting to individuals on the pre-authorized list. The ruling is a major victory for election integrity, states' rights to administer elections, and the people's rights to vote via mail. Brown said in a press release, "The president's attempt to seize control of our elections by selectively refusing to deliver mail-in ballots was unconstitutional and dangerous, and the court was right to strike it down. We will continue to defend the right of eligible Washington voters to participate in our democracy." The district court's decision declares key sections of the March 2026 executive order unconstitutional and blocked the Trump administration from enforcing the provisions for the November general election this year. The judge said the administration is prohibited from doing anything to take control of states' voter rolls and is barred from investigating state election systems based on the unconstitutional provisions in the executive order. The order also bars the Postal Service from refusing to transmit mail-in or absentee ballots from voters registered in plaintiff states to election officials in plaintiff states. Trump's executive order directed the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Social Security Administration to create a nationwide list of verified U.S. citizens over the age of 18, and it also called on the U.S. Postal Service to create a system to handle and accept mail-in ballots only from voters on pre-approved lists. Washington is one of 14 states, including the District of Columbia, where ballots are counted if postmarked on or before Election Day. But a ruling expected from the Supreme Court could eliminate that grace period. In March, the Supreme Court heard oral arguments in Watson versus Republican National Committee, a case that could reshape how states handle mail-in ballots that arrive after Election Day. Under Mississippi law, ballots postmarked by Election Day are counted as long as they arrive within 5 days. The case asks whether the 5-day grace period is constitutional. Democratic U.S. Senator Maria Cantwell of Washington, who is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee and a senior member of the Senate Finance Committee, warned legally eligible voters in Washington that the federal government could reject their ballots because of a U.S. Postal Service policy change that took effect in December. Under the new rule, mail is postmarked when it reaches a regional processing center, not when it is first received at a local post office. The Spokesman Review reported Cantwell said the Snohomish County Auditor's Office conducted a test in February around the state's special election, which found fewer than half of 15 test ballots mailed before 9 a.m. were postmarked the same day. In a speech on the Senate floor this week, Senator Cantwell called out the Trump administration's war on mail-in voting. Cantwell said, "Disenfranchisement today is more bureaucratic, it's more technical, but the results for ordinary citizens can be the same. Their voices are shunned out of democracy." A spokesperson for Washington Secretary of State's office said the office recommends voters use the state's secure ballot drop boxes, which are available 24/7 beginning 18 days before each election. United States Postal Service spokesperson Helen Smith said she recommends mailing ballots 7 days prior to Election Day. Smith said if a voter must mail their ballot, the Office of the Secretary of State encourages them to vote and drop their ballot off as early as possible. Spokane County Auditor Vicki Dalton, a Democrat, said voters who want to cast a ballot by mail less than a week before Election Day should walk into a post office and request that a postmark be applied by hand. Dalton said the recent change in how the Postal Service processes mail has created a delay in postmarking, partly because mail is now being transferred from post offices to regional processing centers only once per day. Dalton said the transfer is now occurring in the morning, which means any mail deposited during Election Day will not be sent to the processing center until the next day. That mail will receive a postmark that is too late to be accepted and counted. Washington's primary elections are on Tuesday, August 4th. Spokane Haitian community leader Luke Jasmine III says a quarter of the Haitians living in Spokane are now under threat of sudden deportation due to the Trump Supreme Court's 6-3 ruling yesterday, allowing Trump's racial cleansing project to move forward. Jasmine says there are about 500 Haitians living in Spokane legally, but the new Supreme Court ruling will likely outlaw their presence here in the U.S. of 150 of them. Jasmine told the Spokesman Review, "We were confident that the Supreme Court was going to rule in the community's favor, so this is a major shock to a lot of us. I think folks are just really reeling right now." He recommends those at risk of deportation carry multiple forms of identification and minimize travel. Jasmine said of the ruling Thursday, "I think this just shows a glaring need for us to actually look at our immigration policies in the United States because these are hardworking people." Republican U.S. Representative Michael Baumgartner of Washington's 5th Congressional District, who is up for re-election this year, claimed the Trump Supreme Court's decision is common sense. Baumgartner said temporary means temporary, and that if one president can use the law to let a group in, that the next president ought to be able to say that was a temporary status. With that being said, in the aftermath of the ruling, Haiti is a very dangerous place, and there are a lot of Haitians with temporary status in important industries like healthcare. It's a common sense decision by the court, but I hope the administration also uses common sense as it seeks to enforce the removal of the temporary protection in an orderly and thoughtful fashion. Democrats representing Washington in Congress apparently don't think that's likely. U.S. Senator Patty Murray of Washington said pushing out TPS holders will hurt everyone who knows and loves these hardworking people who call America home. Should seniors lose beloved caregivers, and should hospitals lose nurses and other critical support staff, all to satisfy a hateful and irrational immigration policy being pushed by this administration? Republican Representative Russ Fulcher of Idaho's 1st Congressional District, who is also up for re-election this year, said he supports the court's decision and implied he thinks that giving Trump the authority to kick Haitians out protects the country. Fulcher said, "If we can't maintain some degree of control over managing that population, then we're not doing our job to protect this country. Now, coming up with the policy on who stays and who goes, that's a different deal, and it's got to be done on a case-by-case basis." You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Local efforts to improve the lives of older adults in Washington State will get a boost this year through AARP's Community Challenge Grant. 11 grantees have been announced, and each will receive up to $15,000 to implement projects that help communities become more age-friendly. Tiana Cooper is with Rainfall Ranch Rescue, which will use the funds to create an outdoor garden space and host classes geared towards adults age 50-plus in rural Pierce and Kitsap counties.
I want to make this something that is accessible to everyone. Public transit can get you here. We can have a program that can pick you up with a shuttle. Everything could be within reach for everyone. And there's not any time we'd have to say, actually, it's not going to work for you.
Cooper says many older adults in the area, like her parents, have lost access to garden space and places to socialize. She says the garden will be up and running by August and hopes it will be a welcoming, free environment for anyone to come anytime to work or enjoy the space. The Cedro Woolley Fire Department will use its Community Challenge grant to buy secure lock boxes for residents at high risk of falls or medical emergencies. Attached outside doors, the boxes hold a house key for fire department access. Assistant Fire Chief Jerry Gardner says they'll let first responders enter without breaking doors or windows.
It also is time-saving. For us to know that we have this on the door, we grab the key, we go. We're not trying to figure out how to get in and spend minutes doing that.
Gardner says the grant, along with other funding from the local Rotary Club, will allow them to purchase 18 lockboxes they can loan out to people that need them. With this year's grants, AARP Washington has awarded more than $550,000 to nearly 60 community projects across the state since 2017. I'm Isabel Charlet, Washington News Service.
KRFP is sponsored by Mikey's Euros, specializing in Greek and Middle Eastern cuisine, such as Euros, falafel, hummus, and tabbouleh, located at 527 South Main Street in Moscow.
KRFP is also sponsored by
Hodgins Drug and Hobby of 307 South Main Street in Moscow. Hodgins features a pharmacy, educational toys, and hobbies. Hodgins also sells and services hearing aids. You can call Hodgins at 208-882-5536. KRFP supports progressive values, including multiculturalism and environmentalism.
As a doctor, I've seen too many women with breast cancer who could have avoided extensive treatment or even death had they just gotten an annual mammogram. Every major medical organization experienced in breast cancer recommends annual mammograms for women 40 and older. Please, if you are 40 or older, get a mammogram every year. If you have a family history or other risk factors, talk to your doctor about what's right for you. To find an accredited center, visit mammographysaveslives.org.
Tune into Live on KEXP, exclusive live performances recorded in the shadow of the Space Needle. On the show next time, it's the Nigerian Afrobeat of Sean Kuti and Egypt 80.
No carry me go, anywhere where I don't know. No carry me go,
no carry me go,
yeah, anywhere.
It's one-of-a-kind sessions from your favorite artists and from a few you're about to discover. From our studios in Seattle, it's Live on KEXP.
Coming up Saturday at 3:30 p.m.
The Moscow Food Co-op encourages the daily use of reusable bags, reusable produce bags, and reusable bulk containers in efforts to minimize the amount of single-use products entering the waste stream through the Change for Good Bag Token Project.
All the vegetables will respond to you.
I jump up and down and hope you toss me a carrot.
Here's another way to help KRFP, one bag at a time.
You have three choices for where your bag tokens go when you visit with your co-op cashier during the months of April, May, and June. And your community radio station, KRFP, is one of them.
Bag tokens. The Moscow Food Co-op.
I'm red as a beet.
You You're tuned in to KRFP Moscow Pullman. This is the KRFP Evening Report, extended Friday edition. With rain in the forecast, firefighting efforts at the Shingle Creek Fire south of Riggins will get some help, but it also may cause some difficulties. The Shingle Creek Fire has burned about 600 acres. Fire specialists say the fire presents no threats to homes or to the Rapid River Fish Hatchery at this time. They say the fire, which started Sunday, is not expected to grow with any significance. According to the Lewiston Tribune, weather forecasters predict a potentially significant rain pattern today and tomorrow, with 1 to 2 inches of rain in parts of Idaho and Montana. The National Weather Service office in Missoula has issued an unusually late winter storm watch for 8 counties in Montana and Idaho. Rain is expected in the lower elevations, while there's a strong possibility of snow in the mountains. Northern Rockies Incident Command Team Fire Information Officer Kyra Powell said, if that comes to fruition, it's unlikely we will see a lot of fire behavior. Powell said despite that, the wet weather could create problems for firefighters trying to establish wildfire containment lines on the northern part of the fire near Riggins. She said firefighters are running into some very challenging and very dangerous terrain with cliffs and loose rocks above them. The weather is going to slow that effort. Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest fire specialist Jim Weimer said as soil and fuel dries, grasses, brush, and trees will become tinder dry. Weimer said because of the overly dry conditions and low snowpack, firefighters are expecting a difficult fire season. He said the rainy forecast will help dry soil, but if the moisture comes and goes too quickly, the ground will not have the consistent moisture it needs to slow fires down. Weimer said, if we get it all in one shot in 24 hours, we don't retain that much in the soil and fuels. We have been trending a couple weeks ahead of what I would call normal. Meanwhile, the National Weather Service has issued a winter weather advisory for the Yellowstone Park area and parts of eastern Idaho and southwestern Montana. The winter weather advisory says total snow accumulations up to 4 inches above 6,500 feet in elevation, with localized amounts in excess of 8 inches near the higher peaks.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Friends of the Clearwater, a 501c3 environmental nonprofit dedicated to protecting your public lands. FOC is defending the wildlands, wildlife, and waterways of north-central Idaho for future generations. Friendsoftheclearwater.org.
We now turn to our featured segment, an interview with Friends of the Clearwater Forests Policy Director Jeff Jewell. The U.S. Forest Service's 8-page plan for emergency logging across 6 regional national forests released this week says up to 5 million acres could be logged this year in Idaho and Montana. The summary does not have a map or description of where the logging will take place and instead says the agency plans to remove pockets of fallen trees within millions of acres of Nez Perce Clearwater, Idaho Panhandle, Lolo, Flathead, Bitterroot, and Kootenai National Forests. The Daily Montanan reported the Forest Service published the summary on their website Monday, and the announcement was not accompanied by a press release. It set a public comment deadline for next Monday, June 29th. The Forest Service says it wants to remove trees that have blocked roads and trails due to straight-line windstorms that swept the region. one in December and one in March. The Forest Service said the downed trees will add fuel loads to the fire-prone forests and that the commercial value of the downed trees will decrease quickly if they are not removed quickly. Friends of the Clearwater Executive Director Jeff Jewell said there is no emergency. That is a completely phony proposition. They are using that to bypass public participation. That raises a big red flag with conservationists, and it should with the public. Trees fall all the time. There is no danger out there, at least not one that doesn't exist every single day. I spoke with Jeff Jewell earlier in the day, in depth about the Forest Service's giant salvage timber sale, plus other efforts to put control over forest policy in the hands of extractive corporations and other damaging interests, such as off-road vehicle users. The Forest Service has announced a major emergency salvage timber sale across six national forests in Idaho and Montana. And some of the headlines say up to 5 million acres, although I think the document says 1.04 million acres are suitable for treatment, as they say. Tell me how bad these windstorms are and you know, how necessary these sorts of salvage logging operations are.
Well, first I want to point out that the document displays more like nearly 12 million acres where this logging could occur and really has no limit on the acreage or really much at all. Everywhere outside of wilderness on these national forests is open, is what the document says.
And it won't necessarily be just downed trees, right? I mean, they could just find trees that they consider dangerous or slightly broken and cut those down as well?
Well, yeah, that's part of the whole ruse of this being an emergency. I know that your listeners have probably walked in natural forests before, and lo and behold, there are things like fallen trees. There are trees that are leaning. There are dead trees, snags, all kinds of things that are just reflective of a naturally functioning ecosystem. But they're not an emergency.
Okay, finally, I want to go to another thing that President Trump did affecting public lands just this month. He signed an executive order repealing Nixon's 1972 executive order and Carter's 1977 executive order, which requires the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to designate trails for off-road vehicles only in places that minimize damage to habitat and minimize conflicts with other recreational uses. So that is repealed. What do you see happening in the next 2 years of the Trump administration because of that executive order?
Well, the executive order is charged the government with writing regulations based on that. So it really hasn't affected things on the ground just yet, but it will, certainly, as you know it. And I just want to point out that those executive orders were first issued, you know, decades ago because it had been noticed that motorized use on national forests and public lands was starting to have a severe impact on things like wildlife and many other aspects of the forest, you know, and the security of things like elk and grizzly bears and everything else that doesn't really cohabit very well with machines and the disturbance they bring and the masses of people that could be brought. So there needs to be areas that are protected and regulated. And so now taking away this regulation could very well mean that roads that are closed or wildlife habitat for winter range, or places where mountain goats need security, for places where grizzly bears need secure areas that are quiet and non-disturbed, that such areas will now be unregulated. And it does very much concern me, the implications and the potential impacts of this repeal of the travel management rules. So, yes, we'll be doing what we can to push back on that.
Will the Forest Service be repealing the travel management rules on a case-by-case basis because of this executive order, or does the executive order just wipe them out entirely?
I don't fully understand that, but my guess is that any kind of rule that is in place, or any kind of forest plan constraint, for example, would have to be taken apart piece by piece. But on the other hand, a lot of things, just like a lot of things, the way the agency operates nowadays, I could find out otherwise. It could be suddenly they could say, well, all these travel management road closures we've made based on travel planning, we're just pulling those back and just withdrawing them completely. And if you don't like us, you don't like it, you know, you're going to have to sue us. So who knows? It really is an open question. And it does reflect, of course, again, it's just the agency doesn't respect nature and quiet recreation and the values that a lot of Americans enjoy on natural habitats and national forests and public lands.
Finally, Jeff Jewell, Friends of the Clearwater mainly focuses on the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest area, and obviously your strategies of working with the Forest Service are going to have to change because of all the radical changes that the Trump administration has imposed on them. Where do you think, and I would also assume that you feel that the Friends of the Clearwater's work is all the more important now. What are your thoughts about future actions and the future work of the Friends of the Clearwater in the next couple of years?
Well, certainly it's changed, and that's a very good question. And we're going to have to adapt to this. I think a lot of our work is going to have to involve public education. And thank you very much, by the way, for the opportunity to carry out that part of our mission as part of this interview today. I really appreciate it, and the organization does, is because we're going to have to do more outreach, more education, to rally people to advocate for what they value on national forests. Eventually, public pressure stands a good chance of pushing back and changing. I mean, those are the kind of things that have always forced change, is when people just rise up in sufficient volume and numbers to say enough is enough. We want to see changes. We want to see things done right. And so that's the kind of thing we're going to have to be doing. That doesn't mean we won't be commenting on projects like this, or won't be invoking science and feeding back straight information to the agency and going to court as we can. It's just that those opportunities will be harder and harder to come by.
Do you anticipate an emergency lawsuit against this emergency salvage sale?
Well, we are contemplating legal action, but at this point in time, it's a little too early to really say that we're ready to go to court. But obviously, we think that this is, you know, even the way they're invoking this emergency, it doesn't even really qualify under their own very liberal regulations that relax things like the normal laws that restrain this kind of thing. So we think they're stepping it out too far. how we might approach that in going to court. It's not quite known yet, but we may soon figure out a way, and then you should be hearing about that.
Okay, well, Jeff, thank you for your time. Do you have anything you need to add right now? We've pretty much covered everything, I guess.
Well, I'm glad to answer your questions and take the time. Again, I would just urge your listeners to pay attention to these issues, stay involved, ask us questions, attend our events, because you're going to learn a lot. And that's mainly what I would like to say. Thank you. I also want to point out that it's not only trees that are down or leaning, which is the document says. The proposal document also says that they're looking at clear cutting in areas where trees are inappropriate or not appropriate for that site. And that's kind of code for what tree farmers use to justify taking out all kinds of trees, because they declare that, well, we know better. The tree species should be something other than what's here. And so that being the case, and that being what the Forest Service is saying, it's not a matter of just blown down trees or leaning trees at all. It's just about any kind of excuse that they normally use for timber sales, which is should be alarming to anybody reading this, that the Forest Service is not even saying where this is that they're going to do it, just saying that they will.
Yeah, normally when they release a planned timber harvest, there's usually a map that goes along with it and so forth. In this case, there's no map, right?
Right. They're just kind of declaring emergency, and it's kind of what authoritarian governments do. They declare something's an emergency, and bang, democracy goes away, and public rights go away, and including, in this case, the rights to comment on and know where the agency is going to promote logging.
Right. They said there's a public comment period open until Monday of next week, and they only officially announced this sale on Monday of this week, which would be the 22nd. So that's an egregiously small window of opportunity to comment on something that you don't even have a whole lot of details on. I mean, are you actually encouraging your supporters to make a comment, and what comment would they make?
Well, I would encourage people to say that, tell the Forest Service that this is not an emergency, that this is just the Forest Service making up excuses to log wherever they want, whenever they want, for the next few years on these national forests, and not tell the public, and the public won't know until we go out and see it on the ground, unless we send requests for information to the Forest Service and they actually provide the information, which is questionable these days, the way they have been so defunded and there are so few people that they don't respond for with information very readily when I make requests, and other people I know make requests.
And this is all sort of goes back to DOGE too, because there were 2,000 forest probationary, what they said, forest workers terminated just in the first month of the Trump second term. How is that affecting environmental analysis now? And has there been pushback on, you know, people getting their jobs back?
Well, one way it's affected environmental analysis is instances like this, where the quality of work is very poor or non-existent, or it's being given to private entities to do the job, which is alarming to the degree that it's privatizing national forests. I have a hard time getting straight answers to simple questions over email with the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest officials. I noticed that they communicate with prospective timber sale purchasers. And when I ask about those things that I find out about, that the letters they send to purchasers, the Forest Service doesn't answer my questions about it. So doesn't that indicate that the National Forest is now being privatized? It's being basically turned over to private interests, and the public isn't being allowed to know what's going on. And this is a perfect example of that.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that they were responding well to timber industry questions. So it sounds like they're prejudice against ecologists, scientists, environmentalists, and people who respect biodiversity and are in favor, you know, giving the benefit to the commercial logging in their responses to your questions.
Yeah, it gets back to your question about Doge. You know, the downsizing of federal agencies. And in this case, I can, you know, having watched the Forest Service for a few decades now and watching what's going on, in this case, severely downsizing the agency personnel, which makes them much less efficient and much less responsive to the public, which then leads to claims of, well, the agency can't do it anymore. They just can't do the job. So we're going to replace them with private entities. It's pretty, you know, it's a pretty obvious succession of events. Blame the agency that you've taken the money away from, turn over their jobs to private industries who are going to profit from the public resources, and say you solved the problem.
And what do you have to say about Mr. Schultz, Trump's appointment for the new Forest Service chief, who just took over, I guess, in the middle of last year?
Well, he's been fully associated with the timber industry, especially in Idaho, for a long time. So basically, you've got somebody who is totally with his roots and in utilizing our natural resources for private profits, running the agency. I guess that's, you know, the implications there are obvious.
Okay, and this decision to do the salvage timber sale over six national forests, it basically just goes up to him, right? It's his decision.
Well, it's not clear that anybody's going to sign a decision. That's even part of the lack of documentation that they're using under these so-called emergency authorities that their proposal cites. They don't even have to write a formal decision. They could be out there right now with industry people facilitating logging. It says that in the document that they don't have to wait for a final decision or even final analysis to start this logging. If that's the case, you know, there could be log trucks rolling right now that are implementing this. We don't know, and they're not answering questions about this, as I indicate. So it's really a pretty sad situation in terms of how our national forests have been basically turned over to private interests.
And I just sort of want to circle back to your comments about certain areas where the Forest Service says there are, I think the word was inappropriate trees or trees that don't belong there. I mean, is this basically a war on biodiversity, the natural landscape versus creating a sort of a monocropping sort of tree farm?
Well, The Forest Service, in its sort of very much tree farming mentality, has always taken the position that, you know, the agency knows better than nature what is right for these forests. And of course, that is a dominated control colonialist type mentality that has, you know, has been growing in this agency for decades now and has been based on industry viewpoints, propaganda even, that forests are sick or unhealthy and we can make it healthy by clear cutting it or whatever they want to do. And therefore, it'll become more resilient or whatever it is, you know. It's whatever excuse they use. And so the way they're saying about this one, they're saying, quote, undamaged trees are not It says, regeneration harvest would occur where blowdown was so severe that areas do not have enough undamaged trees to be considered sufficiently stocked, or where undamaged trees are not appropriate species for the site. Not appropriate for the site. In whose judgment? Well, the tree farmers, not the ecosystem, because the ecosystem is obviously creating these trees. So you can kind of get the gist of what they're all about here.
Yeah, and I want to read one sentence from the timber document that got released this week for the salvaged timber sale across six national forests. It says, wind felled and damaged trees of conifer species native to the northern Rockies are highly susceptible breeding material for associated native bark beetles, including pine engraver beetles, spruce beetle, Douglas fir beetle, and potentially fir engraver, and several species of wood-boring insects. They also go on and say the recoverable value of downed and damaged trees decreases with time. So do you find fault with that statement?
Well, you know, if you're farming a cornfield and you want to maximize the production of food, then you go out of your way to prevent insects, corn blight, disease, whatever, from affecting the crop. But if you have a native ecosystem where insects, tree diseases, all these kind of things are part of the normal process, then why are you demonizing these natural processes when in fact they act to create habitat for wildlife, where they create where they recycle soil and create all kinds of things that the whole ecosystem uses. It's part of the natural process of a forest where trees grow, they die, they fall back to earth. The carbon is stored underground. They hold water for times in drought and provide sites for recycling of nutrients that get later turned into trees. And so what's wrong with that? Isn't that how forests are supposed to work? Not according to tree farmers. They have to control everything.
So how bad were these windstorms in December and March compared to, you know, windstorms in the past that have blown down trees?
Well, you know, I hadn't really heard about anything that was that dramatic. In 2024, there were a huge wind event that affected parts of, well, for example, the Upper Lhoksaw area in the Clearwater National Forest. And it knocked down a lot of trees, damaged some cars and campgrounds, and the Forest Service they had to shut down these campgrounds, the Wendover and the White House campgrounds along the Lhoksaw River, and pull out a lot of damaged trees and restore those sites so that camping, you know, people could camp there. That's an area that is manipulated for the purpose of human recreation. And so those areas, that was quite if you were there, I'm sure it would have been quite catastrophic. But that's the way nature works. But I haven't heard of, you know, more recently, I haven't heard of just huge areas of blowdown. And in fact, you know, you don't even see how big of an area and extent that they're claiming. They don't say any acreages. They're just saying it's an emergency. So, you know, it just sounds like I'm just being very, you know, overly dramatic about it, but it's a scam. It's a ruse. They're saying it's an emergency, so just trust us to fix it.
Have you heard of any windstorm blowdowns in the portions of the Nez Perce National Forest in Latah County? I know the small part of the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest is in Latah County.
Well, I live in Missoula County over in Montana, so I can't tell you, you know, I didn't hear any news events around there. But the Lolo National Forest, which surrounds where I live, surrounds Missoula, is also part of this emergency area. And lo and behold, I have not heard, you know, until this proposal, of there being some huge areas of blowdown and emergencies and da-da-da. And that's part of the reason why I know that this is just made up and probably hugely exaggerated. I don't doubt that there are areas that where windstorms blew down trees. But is that an emergency? Is that unusual? Hardly.
And of course, it's June already, so people have been out in the forest hiking, had opportunities to take photos and so forth, so you would have known about it.
Well, has the Forest Service put out emergency closures saying, please, everybody stay out of areas X, Y, and Z because there's been an emergency? No, because there is no emergency that way. It's really, you know, it's just blatantly obvious that this is an agency that is just responding to total private interest. It's, the agency's been taken over and totally corrupted. I'm not being overdramatic here. I'm telling the truth. This is the situation we're in our public lands.
Okay, and I do want to touch on a couple other things that have been happening with the Forest Service in the last year under the second Trump administration. And one is the consolidation of Forest Service research offices in, I believe, only two locations, which would mean that a lot of the scientists who do research at various research stations around the country, in Portland, one near Ellensburg, and just in quite a few places, I think a couple dozen, will have to relocate if they want to keep their jobs or just basically quit. What are you hearing about, and what do you think the impact is going to be of this?
Well, I know about as much as you do about, you know, these offices. In fact, I think with the details you just read, you know a few more. But I have been following this situation where the closures of research stations is ongoing. And I would first ask, why is the Trump administration afraid of science? Well, I think your listeners are probably aware of the answer to that in terms of things like other issues such as healthcare. The whole idea is that vaccines might be, you know, something wrong with vaccines, whereas we know that scientifically they are of a benefit. You know, the whole idea that science, you know, there's it's the Trump administration and it's war on facts, you know. Our president can hardly open his mouth without spewing lies. So it's not surprising that they're attacking science. And right. I also just want to point out that, you know, the Forest Service research stations are not exactly bastions of unbiased scientific research and whatnot. You have to remember that they're being funded by the federal government, by the same agency that's promoting logging, so that they're not necessarily the most unbiased. I would point towards peer-reviewed science, which is, you know, journals where experts from disciplines criticize each other's or give feedback to each other's writings before the documents are ever published to make sure it's consistent with good science. And that's not the kind of thing it's often the case that peer review doesn't happen with Forest Service research. So I'm not exactly crying about them being closed. I'm just pointing out that it just shows you the degree to which these scientific research stations and the fact that they're putting out anything at all that resembles science is being attacked.
And you're listening to an interview with Friends of the Clearwater Forest Policy Director Jeff Jewell, speaking about changes in Forest Service policy that are impacting the environment of the forests in the Northern Rockies. We'll be back with more of the interview with Jeff Jewell in just a moment.
Programming on KRFP is brought to you in part by One World Cafe, specializing in craft coffee, fresh baked pastries, artisan sandwiches, weekend brunch, wine, beer, and cider on tap. One World Cafe has a web calendar for upcoming live events and a campus location in the Janssen Engineering Building. Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by
Fiddler's Ridge Farm, a family-owned and operated plant nursery serving the Palouse since 1992. Fiddler's Ridge features annuals, perennials, trees, natives, and soil amendments. 1001 Fiddler's Ridge Loop in Potlatch. 208-875-1003.
This is KRFP Moscow Pullman. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report Extended Friday Edition. And we're playing an interview with Friends of the Clearwater Forest Policy Director Jeff Jewell that was recorded earlier today. He's speaking about the various changes in Forest Service policy, the almost total elimination of public input on forest policy decisions for various projects, and the newly announced Forest Service salvage project over six national forests in Idaho and Montana that is going on this summer.
Right. I suppose there are some cases of good research that these Forest Service research stations have done for the sake of biodiversity and the ecosystem that will no longer occur because of this consolidation.
Oh, absolutely. In my work and commenting on projects, I cite a lot of their own scientific conclusions because, you know, they can't just go so completely wacky that it makes no sense. So any kind of logic that's scientifically based, there's integrity to it and there's a lot of facts to it. But again, like I say, there's often bias, and especially in terms of interpreting the science, which the managers do.
And a lot of this research, that whether it's done by the Forest Service or maybe an independent university and so forth, is especially important right now because of the increasing amount of droughts and climate change. And of course, you talked about Trump having a war on facts, and Trump has actually famously said that that climate change is a hoax. Any comments there?
Well, I mean, it's pretty much a scientific consensus as anything in science can be, that climatologists have recognized climate change as a fact and its cause in human activities. It's pretty clear. So when the president is being a climate denier, that's just kind of a symptom of his overall, I guess, his overall view on facts and science. Everything has to be, to him, filtered through what makes him or his cronies the most money. And unfortunately, right now, there's still a lot of money to be made drilling, extracting oil and coal and natural gas and selling it to consumers. So as long as that capitalism is our form of economic activity, you know, this sort of mass capitalism with very few people getting tons of money and getting very rich, we're in trouble. The truth is in trouble.
And I know when the Friends of the Clearwater challenges timber sales or sues the Forest Service, it's often because, at least included in the challenges, is the fact that the Forest Service isn't taking the impacts of climate change seriously. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. Forests are one of our best mitigators of climate change. They store carbon, both in living trees and other living things on the forest. In the soil, especially, is a very heavy carbon storage facility, you could say. That's just the wrong word, but there's a lot of carbon storage in the soils and in the organisms, as well as the dead wood. And these things are being damaged by logging, and the carbon is being emitted during logging operations, whether it be, you know, creating wood products, burning things. Wood products don't last very long, and then they're eventually emitted into the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. So forests are just tragically being downgraded in terms of their ability to help mitigate climate change. And then, of course, forests suffer the effects too, because it changes the way forest ecosystems work and can make it harder for organisms to adapt to the changed conditions, which includes the threatened and endangered species. Everything's connected to everything else, as the ecologists like to say. And when we are doing damage to the carbon storage capabilities of forests, we're creating impacts to the atmosphere, and it circles right back around.
Even without these emergency salvage sales, the National Environmental Policy Act, which requires public participation on major decisions, has been greatly weakened. Is this salvage timber sale, does it represent a coup de grace where they're just going to take whatever they want, and there's not really going to be any regular timber sales anymore where people can actually comment under NEPA? And even though NEPA's been weakened, there is a requirement for public participation without these emergencies.
Well, I guess you could say this is the culmination of that weakness. You know, they're citing emergency clauses. They're citing things in regulations that they've changed. I want to point out, though, this degradation of public participation laws has been ongoing for decades now. It's been happening under both Democratic and Republican administrations. It's been happening when Democrats have the majority in Congress or Republicans.
Okay, finally, I want to go to another thing that President Trump did affecting public lands. Just this month, he signed an executive order repealing Nixon's 1972 executive order and Carter's 1977 executive order, which requires the U.S. Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management to designate trails for off-road vehicles only in places that minimize damage to habitat and minimize conflicts with other recreational uses. So that is repealed. What do you see happening in the next 2 years of the Trump administration because of that executive order?
Well, the executive order is charged the government with writing regulations based on that. So it really hasn't affected things on the ground just yet, but it will, certainly, as you know it. And I just want to point out that those executive orders were first issued, you know, decades ago because it had been noticed that motorized recreation, motorized use on national forests and public lands was starting to have a severe impact on things like wildlife and many other aspects of the forest, you know, and the security of things like elk and grizzly bears and everything else that doesn't really cohabit very well with machines and the disturbance they bring and the masses of people that could be brought. So there needs to be areas that are protected and regulated. And so now taking away this regulation could very well mean that roads that are closed for wildlife habitat, for winter range, for places where mountain goats need security, for places where grizzly bears need secure areas that are quiet and non-disturbed, that such areas will now be unregulated. And it does very much concern me, the implications and the potential impacts of this repeal of the travel management rules. So, yes, we'll be doing what we can to push back on that.
Will the Forest Service be repealing the travel management rules on a case-by-case basis because of this executive order, or does the executive order just wipe them out entirely?
I don't fully understand that, but my guess is that any kind of rule that is in place or any kind of forest plan constraint, for example, would have to be taken apart piece by piece. But on the other hand, a lot of things, just like a lot of things, the way the agency operates nowadays, I could find out otherwise. It could be suddenly they could say, well, all these travel management road closures we've made based on travel planning, we're just pulling those back and just withdrawing them completely. And if you don't like us, you don't like it, you know, you're going to have to sue us. So who knows? It really is an open question. And it does reflect, of course, again, it's just the agency doesn't respect nature and quiet recreation and the values that a lot of Americans enjoy on natural habitats and national forests and public lands.
Finally, Jeff Jewell, Friends of the Clearwater mainly focuses on the Nez Perce Clearwater National Forest area, and obviously your strategies of working with the Forest Service are going to have to change because of all the radical changes that the Trump administration has imposed on them. Where do you think, and I would also assume that you feel that the Friends of the Clearwater's work is all the more important now. What are your thoughts about the future actions and the future work of Friends of the Clearwater in the next couple of years?
Well, certainly it's changed, and that's a very good question. And we're going to have to adapt to this. I think a lot of our work is going to have to involve public education. And thank you very much, by the way, for the opportunity to carry out that part of our mission as part of this interview today. I really appreciate it, and the organization does, is because we're going to have to do more outreach, more education, to rally people to advocate for what they value on national forests. Eventually, public pressure stands a good chance of pushing back and changing. I mean, those are the kind of things that have always forced change, is when people just rise up in sufficient volume and numbers to say enough is enough. We want to see changes. We want to see things done right. And so that's the kind of thing we're going to have to be doing. That doesn't mean we won't be commenting on projects like this or won't be invoking science and feeding back straight information to the agency and going to court as we can. It's just that those opportunities will be harder and harder to come by.
Do you anticipate an emergency lawsuit against this emergency salvage sale?
Well, we are contemplating legal action, but at this point in time, it's a little too early to really say that we're ready to go to court. But obviously, we think that this is, you know, even the way they're invoking this emergency, it doesn't even really qualify under their own very liberal regulations that relax things like the normal laws that restrain this kind of thing. So we think they're stepping it out too far. How we might approach that in going to court, it's not quite known yet. But we may soon figure out a way, and then you should be hearing about that.
Okay. Well, Jeff, thank you for your time. Do you have anything you need to add right now? We've pretty much covered everything, I guess.
Well, I'm glad to answer your questions and take the time. Again, I would just urge your listeners to pay attention to these issues, stay involved, ask us questions. Attend our events because you're going to learn a lot, and that's mainly what I would like to say. Thank you.
That was our interview with Jeff Jules, who is the Forest Policy Director of Friends of the Clearwater. Once again, the U.S. Forest Service's 8-page plan for emergency logging across 6 national forests in Idaho and Montana, released this week, says millions of acres could be logged. The summary does not have a map or a description of where the logging would take place, and instead says the agency plans to remove pockets of fallen trees within millions of acres of the Nez Perce Clearwater, Idaho Panhandle, Lolo, Flathead, Bitterroot, and Kootenai National Forests. The Daily Montanan reported the Forest Service published the summary on their website Monday, and the announcement was not accompanied by a press release. It set a public comment deadline for next Monday, June 29th. The Forest Service says it wants to remove trees that have blocked roads and trails due to 2 straight-line windstorms that swept the region, one in December and one in March. The Forest Service said the downed trees will add to fuel loads in the fire-prone forests and that the commercial value of the downed trees will decrease quickly if the trees are not removed quickly. One quote from Friends of the Clearwater Executive Director Jeff Jewell: "There is no emergency. That is a completely phony proposition. They are using that to bypass public participation. That raises a big red flag with conservationists, and it should with the public. Trees fall all the time. There is no danger out there, at least not one that does not exist every single day." Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow-Pullman area: 30% chance of showers before midnight tonight, otherwise mostly cloudy, low 45, west winds 5, gusts up to 20. Mostly cloudy Saturday, high 63, west winds 10, gusts up to 20. 20% chance of showers after midnight Saturday night, mostly cloudy, low 43, west winds 10, gusts up to 25. 70% chance of showers Sunday, cloudy, high 60, west winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25. 70% chance of showers Sunday night, cloudy, low 43, southwest winds 10 to 15, gusts up to 25, up to a quarter inch of rain possible. And on Monday, showers likely, 70% chance, mainly before noon, mostly cloudy, high 62. Current temperature is 57 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, and the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, plus the public affairs shows, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box that says Support KRFP. You can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business or nonprofit supports community radio. You can adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Once again, we'll gladly accept checks of any amount at KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. I'm Lee Robartis. Brenda Cox and Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant evening. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman Community Radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tiedye-everything.com.
Programming on KRFP is also sponsored by Ungadunga Brewing Company of 333 North Jackson Street in Moscow. Ungadunga features live music, special events, fine food, and craft beers at ungadungabrewing.com and on Facebook and Instagram.